Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from SIRI, an Alaska Native corporation with operations and investments spanning 5 continents, 45 states, and 2 U.S. territories.
There's a lot of hurdles you have to go to work for the Alaska Marine Highway, and you do your part, and then the other end's not followed up on.
A new report says the state ferry system had dozens of qualified applicants, but could only make a few hires. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, March 28th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Representative Mary Peltola reiterates her support for the Second Amendment the day after the Nashville school shooting.
I just appreciate the opportunity to put a plug in for the many, many, many Americans who are responsible gun owners.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The future looks bright because the University of Alaska is on a mission to empower Alaska. From drone piloting to vital climate research to critical mining solutions, the University of Alaska's 3 universities and their community campuses shape the jobs and careers that fuel the economy, creating a more empowered Alaska for all. Learn more at empower.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska.
In Congress today, some Democrats referenced the Nashville school shooting to renew their calls for a ban on weapons like the AR-15. Alaska Congresswoman Mary Peltola, on the other hand, spoke of her support for the Second Amendment. Alaska Public Media Washington correspondent Liz Ruskin reports.
I'd like to recognize the gentlewoman from Alaska, Ms. Peltola.
Peltola spoke at a hearing of the House Natural Resources Committee.
I just appreciate the opportunity to put a plug in for the many, many, many Americans who are responsible gun owners.
The subject was the Pittman-Robertson Act, a 1937 law that taxes guns and ammunition and sends the revenue to the states for hunter education, shooting ranges, and wildlife conservation. Gun ranges, Peltola says, give kids a chance to learn gun safety and to be ethical hunters.
You look at some of the tragedies that are occurring, and those aren't hunters. Those aren't kids that have grown up with hunting and the good values that I think hunting and hunting families provide.
Peltola is a Democrat serving her first full term. Her predecessor, Don Young, was a fierce protector of the Second Amendment and a board member of the National Rifle Association. Peltola has tried to take a middle position on gun control, disappointing some Alaskans who voted for her. Juneau retiree Ben Muse says he got a letter Monday from Peltola's office, a response to a letter he sent weeks ago asking her to support gun control.
It was very vague. She sort of did some hand-waving about the Second Amendment.
Peltola wrote that she supports encouraging safe gun storage and enforcing laws already on the books, as well as prioritizing behavioral health. Muse says he doesn't regret voting for Peltola, but her letter hit him hard, especially coming the same day as the Nashville school shooting.
I understand there's a need to balance the compromise in a state like this, in the different interests. And sometimes compromise involves compromising on things that are painful to compromise on. But the letter she sent me was just totally inadequate to the day.
Peltola's position on guns isn't wholly satisfying to Second Amendment advocates either. The Gun Owners of America lobby gave her a D rating last year. Reporting from Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Falling oil prices have left a massive hole in Alaska's budget, and lawmakers are scrambling to propose alternative revenue streams to close the deficit. A revenue forecast released last week estimated the state has a shortfall of more than $450 million heading into the next fiscal year. Senator Bill Willikowski, an Anchorage Democrat, is introducing a bill to increase oil tax revenue as a way to close the gap.
It's basic math. How are you going to make the math balance out? And it just doesn't balance out at this point.
Senate Bill 114 would close the so-called S-Corp loophole, which would require private corporations like Hillcorp to start paying the state corporate income tax of 9.4%. The bill would also reduce oil tax credits and limit the expenses oil producers can deduct from their state taxes. Willikowski estimates the bill could add more than $500 million to state revenue each year, and he says this is the year to do it.
we've got hundreds of teachers positions that are open. You've got hundreds of vacancies at the Marine Highway. You've got roads that aren't being plowed. And so I think people are really starting to see the impacts of not funding our government.
House majority members expressed doubts about the bill today. House Resources Committee Chair Tom McKay, an Anchorage Republican, says increasing oil production, not taxes, is the solution to Alaska's budget woes.
By bringing forth oil tax increases, does the opposite. It puts a chilling effect on investment.
Other revenue proposals to close Alaska's budget gap are circulating as well. Republican House member Ben Carpenter introduced two bills that would create a 2% statewide sales tax and reduce corporate income taxes. The governor's carbon monetization plans are also moving ahead, though it's unclear when those will start to generate revenue. The Alaska Marine Highway System doesn't have enough crew for all of its ferries this summer. The system needs about 150 more workers, both on water and on land. More than 200 workers have applied for ferry jobs in the last year, but the state has only managed to hire a few. As Coast Alaska's Angela Denning reports, the state is making changes to its hiring systems, but it may be months or even years before the ferry system is running smoothly again.
Micah Hasbrook has worked for the Alaska Marine Highway Service for 17 years.
I've had permanent jobs on the Malaspina, the Taku, the Lakonti, and I've been on the Kennecott now since 2017.
She's an able-bodied seaman, meaning she mans the wheel or does other board jobs reserved for more experienced workers. She loves the work, but says in recent years, the job has been challenging. Longtime staff like herself have had problems keeping their paychecks year-round when the 50- and 60-year-old ships get tied up for maintenance. Other times, she can't get days off. Hasbrook says workers cover extra shifts because of short staffing, and then they're told they can't take vacation because of short staffing.
I always think, oh, it can't get worse. And then it does, but yet the system's still somewhat there. It's mind-blowing.
There's a huge payroll issue going on right now.
Erling Wally is the regional director of the Inland Boatmen's Union of the Pacific, the largest of Alaska's ferry unions. He says paychecks don't always include all of the hours workers turn in. He doesn't blame payroll workers because they're short-staffed too.
We're not pointing it out that it's this person's fault. It's that whole payroll issue. They need to recruit people in there, and we understand that, but we still need to get our members paid.
The shortage of maritime workers is worldwide. The pandemic didn't help. But Wally says Alaska has specific problems. A report released in January by a state contractor shows that people are applying for ferry jobs. The state received 241 applicants over the past year. Even though most were qualified, only 4 were hired. The report said, quote, many applicants were lost due to a lack of timely communication. It said, the process flow is creating a bottleneck in the delivery of information to applicants. Sam Dapsevich is a spokesperson for the State Department of Transportation. He says the applicants got lost in the mix.
There was no single coordinator that was dealing with recruiting and onboarding.
Plus, sometimes the waiting period is too long. Applicants didn't want to wait months for required credentials from the U.S. Coast Guard and the state. Dapsevich says that's being addressed. They now have a position dedicated to recruiting and have a team meeting regularly. They've created a program where new workers can get on-the-job training, so they'll get paid when earning credentials. And they've beefed up advertising. He says they're recruiting on social media, in papers throughout the state and in Washington, and they're hitting job fairs.
Believe it or not, this coming week we have 7 career fairs we're hitting, 2 of them out of state at maritime communities.
But that isn't likely to help in time for this summer. One of the state's main marine highways connects communities from Yakutat in northern southeast to Bellingham, Washington. 2 of the state's largest ferries, the Columbia and Kennecott, were scheduled to run that route. But the DOT announced there's only enough staff to man one of them.
If we were to try to run both of those ships, it was going to result in cancellations, burnout of the crew that we do have.
Dapsevich also addressed the payroll issues the union had complained about. He says those are partly because payroll was moved under the Department of Administration. He says they plan to move payroll back within the ferry system because of the system's specific needs. Wally says despite all the problems right now, The marine highway system is worth fighting for. He says working on ferries can be rewarding. You create a family on board, and you meet interesting people.
This is a good job. This is one of the best jobs I ever had, but you need to get paid, and you need guaranteed work. So I think at this point, the marine highway can only go up. We hit rock bottom.
Robert Venables is the executive director for the Southeast Conference, a regional nonprofit that advocates for economic development. Venables says the marine highway system is in a perfect storm, but it's been a long time coming, starting with a very old fleet. But he says the state has identified new solutions, and his outlook is very positive.
There is a much brighter future ahead, but it's going to take a couple of years to get there.
Venables says it's clear the ferry system is critical to Southeast. It's a lot cheaper than taking a plane and has more flexibility moving cargo, such as vehicles. This year, the organization is planning to get updated information about the impact the ferry system has on communities in the region. Reporting for Coast Alaska, in Petersburg, I'm Angela Denning.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, dancers and musicians, both young and old, are happy to be back at the Chamay Festival in Bethel.
All of us look forward to this because it's our reconnection, you know, with each other, with family.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Parents go to great lengths to protect their little ones. When it comes to protection from childhood diseases, go with the safest, most effective choice. Start strong by getting all recommended vaccines for your baby by age 2. Learn more at vaccinate.alaska.gov. That's vaccinate.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health.
A warning for listeners. The following story includes mentions of suicide and violence against a child. A woman fatally injured a 3-year-old boy and herself today in Anchorage in what police are calling a homicide-suicide. Police say the woman called dispatchers after 10:30 a.m. and said she was going to harm herself. Officers found her and the boy in a parked car outside the Glen Square Shopping Center in Mountain View. Just after the first officer arrived, the woman injured herself and the boy with a firearm. Officers performed CPR on both of them until medics arrived and took them to local hospitals, where both were declared dead. Police declined to answer further questions about the incident today. Neither the woman nor the boy were identified, with the child described by police as a victim of domestic violence. Frederick Young, the Consul General of France, was in Anchorage and Fairbanks last week. The Consul General is based in San Francisco and assists French nationals living in 10 western states, including Alaska. Mr. Young held meetings with city and state officials, attended meetings aimed at trade and commerce, and also met with representatives of the military and oil industry to discuss Arctic concerns. The Consul General says he comes as a Pacific neighbor.
France is a local in the Pacific. That's something that is sometimes forgotten. France has 2 million French citizens living on French land in the Pacific, in the Indo-Pacific region. 10,000 troops also. And a huge, easy, exclusive economic zone for fishing, which needs to be, you know, controlled. And so we actually, the EEZ of France, the economic exclusive zone, is the second largest in the world after the US's ones. And then the second part, of course, which is also of relevance to Alaska, is the Arctic and the polar region. And France has a long tradition of exploration of the poles and of the Arctic region. That's a tradition that has been ongoing, and we have an actual strategy for the Arctic region, which was established last year. Climate is evolving. There are lots of expectations from some countries in terms of also economic exploitation, and so France has very specific views on evolving times regarding the Arctic region.
Before you became the Consul General of France in San Francisco, you worked on disarmament and non-proliferation issues at the UN Security Council for Middle East concerns. Talk a little bit about your thoughts about Russia's war against Ukraine and the potential for it to spill over into a larger conflict, and how that all sort of that concentration on the Arctic is kind of mixed in amongst all of those concerns.
We have witnessed a full-scale, you know, invasion of Russia into the Ukrainian territory, and the views of France on this is very straightforward. It's just like for the U.S., unconditional support, be it humanitarian, be it military, to the, and political, of course, to the people of Ukraine. And so France, along with the U.S., has is providing, you know, support in order to allow the Ukrainian authorities to resist to this Russian aggression. And so France, along with the U.S., is on the side of Ukraine in order to come back to a situation of peace where Ukraine gains back its territorial integrity. And we've seen, you know, quite some frictions around this conflict, including, you know, some very close situations between the U.S. and Russia, especially on the Black Sea. Does this have repercussions on the Pacific area? Well, probably in a way. We've seen a closer coordination in the past period between Russia and China, of course. That's one. And there is an attempt currently for Russia to provide more energy to China. And that's a clear connection that we see. And of course, that's where we are at this stage.
And against that backdrop, with mm-hmm. all of the alliances that we see forming currently, what is your level of concern about a larger conflict, about a third world war?
Well, it's certainly a position of the U.S. and of France to not encourage such an evolution and to work towards appeasement without, of course, changing anything to the support that we are providing to Ukraine. So we have a conflict ongoing between Ukraine and Russia on the Ukrainian territory, and we provide support to Ukraine in this regard. Support that is very balanced and very thought through and coordinated amongst allies. And of course, I think it's a double-pronged objective. First, the first objective is, of course, to, as I mentioned, to get to a situation where Ukraine gets back its territorial sovereignty on one hand, and on the other hand, make sure that there is no escalation of this conflict.
That was Frederick Young, the Consul General of France, based in San Francisco. The Consul General assists French citizens in a 10-state region, including Alaska. He also awarded medals to two French immersion teachers, Brandon Locke and Anne Adasiak Andrew of O'Malley Elementary School in Anchorage.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
ConocoPhillips Alaska, building the next generation of Alaska's workforce through investments in education and vocational training to provide jobs right here at home. ConocoPhillips, Alaska.
The Kodiak Aleutian Subsistence Regional Advisory Council will develop proposals to change federal subsistence hunting and trapping regulations and discuss other subsistence-related issues. The public is invited to participate in the meeting March 29th and 30th in Kodiak. More information at 800-478-1456 or doi.gov/subsistence/regions. This message sponsored by the Office of Subsistence Management.
Maternal deaths went up 40% nationwide in 2021. That includes people who die while giving birth or within 6 weeks after. The rate also went up in Alaska, but Alaska has its own way of measuring maternal mortality, so comparisons to national rates are tricky. In 2021, 20 mothers died in Alaska. It was the highest number of reported pregnancy-associated deaths in the last decade. Ness Varigan leads the state's maternal child death review. They said the increase is a call to arms.
We had a tragic number of maternal deaths, pregnancy-associated deaths during that year.
In Alaska, most of these deaths don't happen during labor. Instead, they happen because of violence afterwards. More than half of maternal deaths in the last 5 years were linked to intimate partner violence. Alaska has some of the highest rates in the nation.
But what I see now is that Alaska's pregnancy-associated rate and those pregnancy-associated deaths due to violence are what we're really looking at, because that's where we're losing most maternal life, is in deaths that are from mental health, substance-related deaths, and homicide and violence.
There's another factor that may have influenced the spike in maternal mortality in 2021, the COVID-19 pandemic. During Alaska's Delta wave, state physicians spoke out about how overcrowding and rationed care at hospitals have had a devastating effect on the maternity ward. And there was an uptick in violence against women throughout the pandemic years. Alaska Native women are disproportionately represented among maternal deaths. Monday was the anniversary of the Great Alaska Earthquake in 1964 and the deadly tsunamis that followed. Before that day, there was no formal way for the government to warn communities about the potential for dangerous waves ahead of time. But in the decades since, scientists have been working to build and refine the tsunami alert system in Alaska. There will be a test of that system on Wednesday. KTOO's Anna Canny has more.
People in coastal Alaska might hear a tsunami warning on Wednesday morning. It's just a test, but the people sending it out are worried that not everyone will know that. That's because the system used to send out tsunami alerts is outdated and overly complicated.
We're operating on a system that is probably closer to where meteorology and weather science was 20, 30 years ago, at least.
That's Dave Snyder with the National Tsunami Warning Center in Palmer. At 10:15 on Wednesday, he'll send a warning signal out to local radio and TV stations. During a real tsunami, warnings would go out on cell phones, too. You'd receive a message on your lock screen with an irritating tone. Snyder says that's not supposed to happen during the test, but it could happen anyway. And that's because of the way automated systems talk to each other. When the warning center puts out an alert, all kinds of non-government entities like social media or weather apps can pick it up and spread it. And sometimes they misinterpret it. That means mobile alerts might not specify that it's just a test.
There could be messages looking like a real problem when it really is just a test message. So we do rely on our third-party private industry and enterprise to make sure that they're making sure that they understand the code that we're using so that they can make sure we're not over-alerting or scaring or harming people through bad messages.
It's also possible that the warnings will reach people outside of the testing zone. That's because tsunami warnings are issued using the same boundaries as weather forecasting. They're generally very large areas, and they're not designed for tsunamis. That's led to imprecise warnings in the past.
One of the results of this will be to see, are there places that are getting this alert that shouldn't? And we may find a couple of those places.
The technology for sending out tsunami warnings is still very much a work in progress. In a report last year, the NOAA Science Advisory Board called for a total overhaul of the U.S. tsunami warning system. But Snyder says that could take decades.
20 years from now, when we've redesigned the alert system, it won't happen. But it's a technology thing, and we're constantly working to refine that.
In the meantime, the warning center is hoping to collect feedback from people in tsunami zones following Wednesday's test. People can submit their comments at www.ready.alaska.gov. In Juneau, I'm Anna Canny.
This weekend, people from across the state came to Bethel to celebrate the three-day Chamai Dance Festival. KYUK's Sunny Bean talked to attendees about their experiences.
I like to watch them and dance on stage.
I was watching.
Dancing. The dancing. I like the blessing one.
Dancing in front of the whole crowd, it feels amazing being back.
You get to go to different worlds sometimes when you're loving.
In your brain, you can picture yourself other places, or you can get lost in dancing.
Well, I got to perform twice with the Kukurumi group and Gladys Jung.
Yeah, I was kind of nervous, but it was fun.
It was nerve-wracking at first, but it's pretty good right now. I love it.
Ever since I was a baby, so I've been performing my whole life.
I've never danced in a long time. The last time I danced was
last time we went to Jamaa was like 3 or 4 years ago. The last time I danced was with my mom. I stopped dancing after my mom passed.
It's to carry on the traditional and keep our traditional going on.
Remember our family members.
The community gets together in spirit and in truth. That's the healing of the community.
It's like bringing back all our people together, having something fun to do and watching.
Just handshaking, hugging people.
Take a break from home.
Food.
I had fun looking at all the different, the people that bring their stuff. They're so marvelous.
This is, a celebration of everybody being able to get together and a celebration of why they were able to get back together.
We always look forward to March. You know, it's a one-a-year event, so it was always good to see new friends, you know, like friends from the villages, family members.
This is my first actual arts and crafts sale. I've been so excited for the last month, ever since I signed up for it. Like, every day I was just reminding myself, I'm going to Jamaa, and, like, I couldn't believe it. It was kind of like my perspective. Like, I'm going to Jamaa. I need to make these women's knives, like, every day. And, like, I couldn't believe it. Like, I thought they were going to be sold out of tables. So every day, I was like, I told myself, I'm going to Jamaa. And I made 68 in a week.
My daughter, she's just starting to learn how to dance, and she's participating, so I'm happy she's learning. So I was proud of her. I am proud of her. So.
I'm just thankful to see more, like, new faces from the villages.
It really brings everybody in so many different cultures together, all in one.
This is my first time attending the Jamaa Festival, and since we are excited, so we also have volunteered.
This is my first time at Jamaa. This is my first art show.
It's my first time here. I enjoyed it.
Jamaa is important for not just Bethel, but for all the surrounding villages and even outlying areas. All of us look forward to this because it's our reconnection, you know, with each other, with family, with other groups that you're looking forward to seeing, especially after the pandemic. It just means so much more right now.
Jamaa is so wonderful this year.
It's actually really fun having the 3 days back.
Community is feeling how I'm feeling, that healing is beginning. Healing has started.
The voices of people who attended Jamaa this week. It was the first full festival in 3 years. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Kavitha George and Chris Clint in Anchorage, Sunny Bean in Bethel, Claire Strempel and Anna Canny in Juneau, Angela Denning in Petersburg, and Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C. If you want to send us a news tip, question, or comment, email us, news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer is Chris Hyde. Tim Rocky is our producer, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. If you love what you hear on your public radio station, consider becoming a member. Public media is designed for and made possible by the communities it serves. Monies generated through estate and deferred gifts enable public radio to provide our listeners, you, with the level of programming excellence you've come to expect. It may also reduce income and estate taxes. Consult your financial advisor or contact your public radio station to learn more. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.